from GPB News. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Who deserves a statue on public land?
Surely there are other symbols that better reflect who we are than those of the Confederacy.
That's Paul in Northeast Georgia. Ahead this hour, we talk about how a person's knowledge of history and their attachment to symbols of the Confederacy are not connected. A recent study asked supporters of Confederate imagery to talk about basic facts of the Civil War. It's part of an ongoing conversation about how to handle Georgia's monuments to Johnny Reb.
Starting with Stone Mountain. We should sandblast the entire side of the mountain.
You want to soundblast Stone Mountain?
Absolutely. Return it to its natural condition as closely as possible.
That's Break Room regular Hector Fernandez. Here are your first thoughts.
Hey, my name is Tim Pangburn. Do you have any idea how big that is and how ineffective sand is to rock? It's not feasible.
Hey, my name is Joel. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. The statue on the side of Stone Mountain is big enough to house a car inside of the horse's mouth. So the idea of sandblasting it is a little misguided. We're really talking about tons of dynamite and creating a place below to catch all of the boulders and parts of the mountain that fall.
Paulus Wood tweets to us, Confederate monuments, I don't care one way or the other. Take it down, leave it up, no skin off my nose. And here's another message, this one from Athens.
Hi, good morning. My name is Susanna Drennan. I've just been wondering if the ones that have to stay or are decided to be kept have to stay, would there be some merit in adding verbiage, really saying what these people believed in, what they fought for, and not whitewashing it so much?
We always want to hear what you think, so call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Thomas Hicks was once a local hero in the small mining community of McKaysville, Georgia. He was the town doctor, and he made middle-of-the-night house calls. But Hicks had a secret that still reverberates today. From 1950 to 1965, he sold more than 200 babies on the black market. Some parents knew, others were told their children had died. These children are now fully grown adults, still known as the Hicks babies. I spoke to Melinda Dawson and Christy Hughes about their search for their birth parents. And I began by asking Christy how she found out about her own past.
Well, it was confirmed for me in 1997 when the Akron Beacon ran an article about the Dr. Hicks and the Hicks adoptees. I had a good idea, but that's what confirmed it for me.
You had a good idea, but nobody told you. You mean you just sensed that you were adopted?
Pretty much. Yeah, my family, that's not something they discussed or would admit to. I had a dream, actually, when I was really young, and I knew in my heart from that point forward, but it was never admitted to me.
So, Melinda, you have not been reunited with your birth mother, but you have been made this a little bit of a mission to help not just yourself, but others find their birth parents. Why?
Well, it's something that our fundamental rights were taken away from us by Dr. Hicks, by selling us on the black market. And I know how I feel and how important it is for me to find who I am, where I'm from, my medical information. And so I have the resources and the networking available to me to try to find things out. So I'm lending that information to everyone else. And we've worked really hard, and I'm very happy for Christy because this has been a great reunion for her.
Now, you mentioned your medical information. I understand it, part of your motivation, or at least some of the inspiration for it, began when you had a grandchild.
Yes. My grandson was born 2 years ago, December 26, and had a medical issue. He is my third grandchild, and it just seemed to me that had we known some medical information, we may have been able, you know, to know ahead of time. And so I felt it's not fair to my children or to my grandchildren to not have medical information from my side. And I also was diagnosed with cancer last year. If I had known some of my information, I could have prevented it.
Melinda, did you grow up knowing that you'd been adopted? Did you know what had happened?
I did. From the age of 7, my mom told me the entire story, but at the age of 7, you just can't, it's not something that you really wrap your head around. So in the ensuing years, I had questions, and my mom always answered me as truthfully as the story that she knew. I had no idea until 1997 that there were other children that were sold from that clinic.
So, Christy, when you finally met your birth mother, I mean, I can't even imagine what that moment was like, but maybe you can kind of help me understand what that must have felt like to meet a birth mother you didn't for a long time even realize existed.
It's like all the stars aligned. It was a miracle. It was an absolute miracle. Beautiful, beautiful. I, through the years, had come to terms with the fact I was probably knowingly given up for adoption, and that was okay. I was in it to find out answers. I mean, answers to my family history, but to find out I had a mom that loved me and I could have grown up with, it's bittersweet. It's bittersweet. We've lost a lot of years.
You also found out that you had, as you say, you had thought that she had given you up willingly, but that wasn't the case.
Correct.
What had happened?
Yes. Dr. Hicks had told her I died at birth and turned around and issued a birth certificate to my adopting parents.
Melinda, do we have any idea at this point? It feels like we don't have as much information as we will in the ensuing years, but do we have any idea how many of the birth parents knew they were giving up their kid and how many the doctor told them that the baby had died?
We don't really have that information since, you know, a lot of us have not found our birth families. You know, if I would guesstimate, probably, and this is totally something that I have thought about, and it's just really estimating, I would say that probably the majority of women were probably told that the baby had died. There was women that went in there full term, and then Dr. Hicks said, you know, the baby had died. And so there were questions, and back in the 1950s and 60s, women didn't really have a voice. But more so, I think that they trusted Dr. Hicks and never questioned him telling them that. And so in the case of Christy's mom, you know, for 50-some years, she has believed that her baby had died. And then along comes DNA, and that's how we're getting the answers that we have been seeking for so long.
And one of the ways that you're doing that is because there's a judge that's helping you to go through the records, right?
No, actually, that was done in 1997. There was a probate judge that was assisting another one of the adoptees by going through the birth certificates and bringing the story out. But that story kind of died away in 2000. And so I picked it back up just last year.
Well, and you have visited McKaysville a number of times since then.
Absolutely. I just got home last night from visiting McKaysville.
So what's the response of the people there? I mean, this is a very small town.
It's a very small town. A lot of the, I guess, local residents have either deceased or moved on. There are some that are left, and they all have a great respect for Dr. Hicks. I don't think that they're in the mindset that he could have done something so dark. And so that's one of the obstacles that we're going to have to hurdle a little bit by not so much focusing on Dr. Hicks, but focus on the fact that we have a right to our birth family. And that's our hometown as well. We're not coming in to try to, you know, put a black mark on McKaysville. That's our hometown too. And so we deserve some answers.
Christy, what was the relationship like with your birth mother once you got back in contact with her?
It's beautiful. It's just immediately bond, so full of love. I have an awesome brother, 3 beautiful nieces, just a beautiful family. It's heartbreaking that we've lost all these years, but it's beautiful. Can't even put into words.
And what is the, I mean, what is now the dynamic between your adoptive family and the birth family?
I still love my adopted family. I was blessed to have ended up with them. Back in the day, there was no checks and balances. Some of us Hicks babies might have went to not so good homes. I went to a good home. I was well taken care of and loved. So the dynamic is, it's still good. It's still there. Just an even bigger, broader family. More love. There's no such thing as too much love.
So, Melinda, how does this move forward? As I understand it, one of the ways that you're identifying would be relatively definitive, and that's through DNA. But that requires people who think they may have lost a baby to come forward, does it not?
There's, with DNA, it can pick up if they have a great niece, or if they, in my case, I have found second cousins that we share the same great grandparent. So the lineage can be traced back as far as the 1400s. So usually with DNA, it's all or nothing as far as maybe that's the birth parent. But now that Ancestry.com, that who we are working with, can do lineage back, you know, hundreds of years, it can help us trace and narrow down to the very birth mother or birth father. It just takes a lot of research.
There must
if
be
that's the case.
Yeah, there must be some of these children, now adults, who don't want to know, maybe. How many have come to you, or that do you know of, that are trying to track down their birth parents at this point?
We have a group of about 15. There was over 200 babies sold out of the clinic, so we're still searching for more, and that's why we're wanting to get the word out that, hey, we're here. We're doing DNA, and also with the birth families, we want them to know that we're out here, and we're just trying to reconnect, not for any other reason, but because they are our family. We deserve to have that knowledge.
Although you can understand that they may be concerned that, you know, people are looking for financial remuneration or anything else. Okay, so what reassurance do you give to someone who may be nervous about coming forward?
Well, I would say to them that the group that we have now and the ones that are coming down the line, coming on board, have all through these years, I mean, we're in our 50s and 60s now. We're not looking for financial gain. We need answers for medical reasons. And quite frankly, that's our right to know who our family is. That's all we're looking for.
That was Melinda Dawson and Christy Hughes. I spoke to them in 2015 about the effort to reunite with their birth parents. So far, Christy Hughes is still the only Hicks baby to meet her birth mother. Earlier this year, Melinda got in contact with a first cousin for the very first time. Just ahead, do you trust e-cigarettes to not kill you? But first, people who support flying the Confederate battle flag often don't know much about Civil War history. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Georgia's legislative session begins January 8th. A bill that addresses the debate over Confederate monuments has already been filed by Decatur's state representative, Mary Margaret Oliver. That bill would allow local governments to decide whether or not to keep or remove monuments. Georgia has about 175 Confederate markers, and they are mostly protected by state law. Supporters often say those monuments are about history, but a recent study casts doubt on that claim. The Georgia State University study used data from 2004. Researcher Spencer Piston of Boston University helped review that data and found many people who support the display of the Confederate flag lack basic knowledge of the Civil War. For example, Piston told us most of the people surveyed couldn't name a single Civil War battle or identify Union General William Tecumseh Sherman.
White people who are more knowledgeable about the Civil War are less supportive on average of Confederate symbols, such as the Confederate battle emblem. We did not expect to find that. We thought it might be the case that there's something to this sort of pride in the history of the South.
The study raises a larger question of the role of historians in explaining the Civil War. For more on that, I spoke to Civil War historian Kevin Levin and Dinah Ramey Berry, a professor of history and African diaspora studies at the University of Texas at Austin. What do you take away? Let me start there. What do you take away from this study that showed a surprising correlation between a lack of knowledge of Civil War history and then support for flying the Confederate battle flag?
You know, I was surprised by some parts of the study and other parts I wasn't, because we kind of had gone down this route in Texas when we were looking at the University of Texas's Confederate statues. And we had several public conversations. And in those conversations, there were a number of people that knew details about battles, but they didn't necessarily look at the larger perspective of the war and the history of the war and the outcomes of the war, which, as your quote earlier stated from the Atlanta History Center president, 4 million African Americans received their freedom as a result of the South losing the war.
And then let me go then to you, Kevin. Were you surprised, as so many people were, by the results of this?
You know, not so much. I think one thing to keep in mind is that quite often people who identify with Confederate iconography, whether it's the flag or with monuments, often tend to filter it through a sort of contemporary or modern day political agenda. So one thing to keep in mind is that the monuments themselves, the symbolism is not always about history. In fact, it might more often be about present-day politics, concerns about race, things like that. So there's two things going on here, I think.
To what extent is this a failure of our educational system? There are people who can't even remember who was fighting in the Civil War. They can't even remember North versus South. So are we simply forgetting our own history, or is it not being taught?
I think it's a couple things. One, I think that the history that has been taught in the past has been not so balanced, for lack of a better phrase. So when I teach American history, African American history, half my class is sitting there for the majority of the semester saying, well, we never learned this. We never were told this part of the story. We were never told this half of American history. Why don't we know about African Americans who were forced to go to the Civil War with their Confederate enslavers? Why were we not told about that, and then them dragging them back and saving them during different battles? How come this history hasn't been included? So I think it's really a part of looking at history to include all groups and the full context of American history, so that we're not just telling one side of the story or showing this celebratory history that we often try to do when we talk about American history.
So let's play a clip of a video taken on the campus of Texas Tech University in 2014. In this, for this project, they asked students on campus questions about history and politics. So here's some of the responses when they were asked about the Civil War.
We did? The South?
Like the one in 1965? What Civil War?
Who won it?
Who was even in it?
Who was in it? Just tell me who was in it.
Ooh, I don't know.
America? I don't know.
That's the Confederates, right?
Okay, so Kevin, I don't even know where to start with this. These are not stupid students. These are many of them studying medicine at Texas Tech University, but don't know who was in the war, let alone who won it. How do we address that?
Well, I'm always a little bit suspicious at these sort of, you know, these attempts to sort of, you know, these gotcha moments, you know, on the streets. And so it is disturbing on the one hand, no doubt. I do think we should take a step back and sort of acknowledge that over the last few decades, you know, we have seen a significant transformation in terms of, you know, how the Civil War is taught in the classrooms, even the high school classroom. Certainly we have a ways to go. But a lot of the myths that were taught a few decades ago, you know, you'll no longer find, at least not as many in the textbooks that we're using. We also have, of course, the internet as a resource, which is both a positive and a negative. So, you know, I think certainly, you know, we can express some concern about the interviews, but I also think that we need to acknowledge, and I think this helps explain why the monuments and the flag is so divisive right now, and that is because, you know, we have seen a shift in how Americans are willing to think about and remember this divisive moment in our history.
All right. So, Dinah, to what extent is this, and you alluded to this already, but I want to go at it specifically. To what extent is this a result of the fact that there was a different telling of the history of the Civil War in the South as opposed to many places in the North? In other words, the fact that the war is still often called the War of Northern Aggression in the South, or that they have often portrayed it as not about slavery, but about states' rights. Has that complicated Americans' knowledge of the facts?
I think it has. And also, I think because there are all these public symbols, when you drive across the state of Georgia or many of the southern states, you'll see monuments, you'll see historical markers that are often identifying Confederate generals or battles or different parts of that history. So I think that's part of the challenge. You don't see those same figures as often in northern states. The other challenge is just understanding the whole history and how it's taught. And I think that's what, you know, Kevin's getting at, that we're in a place where we're now starting to talk about this. This really came to a head in 2015 with the killing of the murder of the 9 African-Americans at the church in South Carolina, Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina, by Dylann Roof. And I think that's one of the catalysts that brought this conversation back up. It was in 2015 that then the state of Georgia stopped officially celebrating Confederate Memorial Day. And so I think because of that, we saw the connection between the hate that comes with some of this celebratory language and also the larger history that this comes out of.
And yet, Kevin, you say that when a community is trying to decide whether to move a monument or take a monument down, you say maybe don't ask historians about that. Why?
Well, I certainly think that historians have a role to play in explaining the historical context of these monuments. Most people don't have a firm grasp of the fact that, you know, the vast majority of Confederate monuments went up at the height of Jim Crow. So this is a point when, you know, especially African Americans certainly did not have a voice in the kinds of public discussions that, you know, that sort of shaped the commemorative landscape. In other words, what was remembered and what was not remembered. So I think historians have that role. They can play that role, and they should. But ultimately, these are, you know, discussions about the broader community, right? You know, it was the broader community that chose to erect a monument at a certain time, and it's the community that ultimately has to decide, you know, whether or not a monument is going to be relocated or removed entirely. And so, again, historians have a role to play. But I think historians are quite often tied to seeing monuments as artifacts that we want to maintain them so we can use them for education purposes. And I certainly have done so with my students and the public at large. But that, of course, you know, has to be placed next to the experience of having to wake up and walk by these monuments and feel as if you are not equal or that you are not welcome in your own community.
And Dinah, this actually became very clear to you. I understand that you, for a while, refrained from talking publicly about your work on the task force dealing with monuments in Texas because someone wrote it in a local newspaper, a threat?
Yes. They threatened to chain myself and other African-American members of the task force to the Jefferson Davis statue and let us sit and let bird poop fall all over us or something like that. I can't remember the exact quote. And that was mild, and we got other threats. That's to be expected. But I also refrained from talking about it because I felt like this was a conversation that really needed to involve the context, like Kevin is saying, the historical context. And people pick the small pieces of or sound bites of the history that they want to remember and are not willing to talk about the larger history. So if I mention enslaved people or I talk about monuments for enslaved people, people will say to me, oh, well, that's a really difficult and uncomfortable part of our history. And for some people, so is the Civil War.
So then what are we to do, Kevin, going forward, especially in evaluating, you know, that Georgia still celebrates Robert E. Lee's birthday, for example. Mm-hmm. How are we to decide what to do with these monuments and what to do about our sort of glaring lack of knowledge about our own history?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I don't I'm not going to pretend that I have an answer, because in part I don't think there really is an answer. Certainly, the shootings in Charleston in the summer of 2015, you know, functioned as the most recent catalyst for this debate, and I think it's safe to say that the last few years, I can't really think of a previous time where it's been this divisive. But you can go back to, you know, for example, the dedication of the Lee Monument in Richmond in 1890, and the editor of a black newspaper, John Mitchell, wrote very clearly. He said the black man was there to put up the monument, and at some point he will be there to tear it down. I'm sort of paraphrasing, but I'm pretty close to his words. I think these are organic discussions. I think that this is part of what it means to live in a democracy. And I think we're now at a time, you know, coming out of the civil rights movement, where people who are barred from engaging in these public discussions now have a voice.
That's Civil War historian Kevin Levin. We also heard from Dinah Ramey Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. This week, the Pentagon announced it will allow openly transgender people to enlist in the U.S. military beginning January 1st. President Trump signed a directive banning transgender military recruits in August. Two federal courts ruled against that ban. Untold transgender service members have already served this country. We talked to one of them. Monica Helms of Marietta brings this commentary.
I pushed around 16 nuclear missiles in the Atlantic Ocean to keep the Russians from blowing us up. And I protected the rights of every American when I was in the military. And I don't seem to get all those rights. There's something wrong with that. My name is Monica Helms, and I'm a transgender activist. I served in the military from 1970 to 1978, and I didn't realize that I was different until the middle of my term in service. And I had to keep it a very strong secret because I knew how they reacted to these kinds of things. I kept all my girl things in my van when I was serving. That way I didn't have anything with me when I was on board the submarine, so I didn't have to worry about anybody finding out. I was very proud of serving in the military, and especially on submarines. My family comes with a very long history of military people. I have uncles that served during the war. My father served in three branches of service and in three wars. My grandfather served in the Navy. My son was a Marine. My brother was an Army person, and his son is an Air Force person at this time. So I have a long history of military service, and I wanted to honorably serve. And so I did not want to leave the Navy until my time was up. The morning that President Trump tweeted about kicking transgender people out of the military, it was just horrible to see the president say such things that we were not worthy in his eyes to serve our country, and yet many of us have served, and many of us are serving openly today. The president is just throwing out a lot of BS when it comes to the money involved in transgender people. First of all, there's not a heck of a lot of us in the military, and second of all, not every one of them is going to want any kind of transitioning services. Many of the people serving today have already transitioned. There's an estimate that 400 women served as men in the Civil War for both sides. We have people who have been from corporals all the way up to colonels and generals, and they have served honorably, some with high security clearances, and many of the friends that I have served 20 years in the military, coming out with an honorable discharge. So there is a lot of people. The history is full of them.
That was transgender activist Monica Helms of Marietta, a Navy submariner from 1970 through 1978. She later transitioned and went on to create the transgender pride flag. That story was produced by GBB's Sean Powers. Just ahead, we open up the gripe bag to vent about reply all email threads. But first, is there a safe way to smoke?
Good Lord, what you don't say, what you don't, I did it just for you, I did it just for you, I did it just for you, and you just don't care. Yeah, all them other dudes by your side.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow we talk with film director John Waters while he's in Atlanta. Waters pushed the envelope with films like Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble. And he brought certain offbeat sensibilities into the mainstream. That includes Hairspray from 1988.
Mother is here.
And we want to hear from you. Who is your favorite indie film director or maybe indie film star? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can send us a tweet at OST Talk, but be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 9 for that conversation. Electronic cigarettes have been around for more than a decade. They allow users to inhale a puff of vaporized nicotine and flavoring instead of smoking. There's no doubt these products are safer than cigarettes if you already smoke. But safe? Not really. And what a person believes about the risks of vaping versus smoking depends on their worldview of authority. That's the gist of a Georgia State University report. Its findings are part of a larger project to help support tobacco regulation with science. I spoke to Michael Erickson about that research. He's the dean of the School of Public Health at Georgia State. What is the extent of what we know about public perception? In other words, we know that the public is very skeptical of e-cigarettes because of your research, but do we know why?
We didn't ask why, per se, but we have an idea that they're getting really conflicted messages from the media and from scientists on either side of the e-cigarette issue, and it's no wonder they're either confused or they think that they're as harmful as cigarettes, and that's just not the right perception. In fact, it's a misperception. But it is a complicated issue because for smokers, there's no question that e-cigarettes are less harmful than smoking, but there are other issues associated with the product. It's not safe, but it's less harmful, and communicating that is a difficult public education mission.
So also with us is Dr. Kristen Higgins, assistant professor at the Department of Radiation Oncology at Emory University's Winship Cancer Institute. Hi, Kristen.
Hello.
So this is a common complaint about medicine, right? That the message is confusing, that people don't know what the bottom line is. Do we have a bottom line on e-cigarettes?
Well, yes, I think we can say that we do. E-cigarettes have been in the U.S. markets since around 2007. They haven't been rigorously evaluated in terms of longitudinal clinical trials where we can really assess what the long-term effects of these e-cigarettes could be.
You said longitudinal studies, but does that mean how many years are we talking in order to qualify as longitudinal?
Well, I mean, I think that we need many years because a cigarette or an e-cigarette causing a cancer could take many, many years.
They've been available.
Exactly. More than 1 or 2 years. We can test the acute side effects of e-cigarettes in users, but in terms of the risk of developing cancer down the road, COPD, long-term pulmonary side effects, we're not going to know that for many years until these rigorous scientific studies have been performed.
Okay, so let me bring that back to you, meaning that right now it feels like what I understand is that e-cigarettes aren't healthy, but they're healthier than a cigarette. But it sounds like Kristen is saying we don't actually know that for sure when it comes to causing cancer.
I think that most people would agree that what you said, that e-cigarettes are not safe, but they're better than smoking, people would agree with. Because for the sole reason that cigarettes are so toxic and so deadly, 1 out of 2 lifetime smokers will die as a result of smoking.
So it sounds like the reason that you had cause for concern, and again, we're talking about this study from Georgia State University that shows the public thinks e-cigarettes are as deadly as cigarettes.
Right.
It sounds like you're concerned about that because you don't want to dissuade smokers from giving up an actual burning, smoking cigarette.
That's right. If we can get smokers to give up a burning cigarette, a combusted cigarette, and try an electronic cigarette, that would clearly be a step in the right direction of improving their health. And I think everybody would agree with that. But that's not saying that these e-cigarettes are safe. It's just that they're safer than continued smoking.
So, Kristen, what are your concerns about the way that e-cigarettes have been marketed?
My concern is that our youth is going to think that these are a safe alternative to, you know, the classic cigarette, and they're going to start using them, you know, to get a nicotine fix, and eventually that will lead to tobacco use.
Oh, you think that it might be a gateway drug is probably a little bit overused, but that it might lead to actual tobacco use.
I think that is a worry, yes.
But are you concerned about the carcinogens or the possible development of cancer from e-cigarettes? Because the e-cigarettes aren't burning anything. There's no smoke.
Yes. Well, I think that the important thing is that we can't make assumptions. We really need to perform, you know, studies and look at rates of cancer development down the road in e-cigarette users. It's really, I think that they probably, yes, are safer than a typical combustible cigarette, but we don't want to assume anything, and we don't want to give that message to the public that we can assume that their cancer risk is going to be negligible if they use this. It needs to be studied in a rigorous fashion.
Yeah, the problem is that there are 40 million Americans who continue to smoke today.
Which
astounds me that there are that many people who do. I mean, smoking rates are at an all-time low, but still 40 million people continue to smoke. And for those 40 million, we really can't wait decades to get the answer on e-cigarettes. We need to get them to stop smoking with whatever means possible. I used to smoke. I quit cold turkey, and most people quit cold turkey. But that's not the only way to do it. There's approved drugs.
And it's also really hard to do that without starting to use them again, quit cold turkey, I mean.
Well, most smokers, in terms of smoking, there are more ex-smokers in the United States today than current smokers. So 53 million Americans have quit smoking, 40 million continue to smoke. So quitting smoking is doable, and most people who've ever smoked have quit. But still there are 40 million who continue. Most people who quit cold turkey. They just quit on their own. Some use pharmaceuticals, some use other means. And I think what we want to do is to get people to quit with however possible. And if that includes e-cigarettes, that's okay.
We're talking about threading a needle here, and this seems to be the problem, Kristen, because you're talking about you don't want people to just take up e-cigarettes either to just use them because they think they're safe or to use them and that eventually leads to tobacco use. He's talking about trying to get people
It's it's two different populations, two distinct populations. You know, I see patients with lung cancer in my clinic every day, and I counsel them on the importance of tobacco cessation, and we talk about what they've tried, what sort of nicotine replacement tools have they used, and we do talk about e-cigarettes, and they work for some people as a tool to stop smoking. And the message becomes...
Do you encounter this perception that people have that they're just as bad as cigarettes?
Yes, I think that there is some confusion amongst the general public. Yes, I do encounter that perception.
So how do we thread this needle between making smokers know that e-cigarettes are safer and letting everybody else who's maybe not using or thinking about using know that they're not safe?
Well, I think one important thing is that within the medical community, primary care physicians and, you know, all of the medical community really needs to stay abreast of the current literature that's coming out about e-cigarettes, because there is a lot of new literature that's being published every day, and we really need to stay on top of it so we can convey the appropriate message to our patients. I think it needs to be an individual message. It needs to be individualized to the patient that's sitting in front of you in your office. What is their problem? You know, do they have a lung cancer? Do they need to stop smoking today? you know, and the message is going to be different depending on the individual patient scenario.
I think the needle isn't that difficult to thread. I think that the message for smokers is first quit immediately, because there's nothing more you could do for your health than quitting. Secondly, if you tried other methods and they haven't worked, try e-cigarettes and see if they can help you. They can give you the nicotine that you're addicted to, and you could ideally stop e-cigarettes as well. But stopping combustion is number one. The other part of the message is that there's no role for nicotine, either cigarettes or e-cigarettes, for kids. And that is not acceptable. We know it damages the brain. Nicotine increases craving for other drugs in the adolescent brain. And the third part of the message is that, unfortunately, most people who try e-cigarettes continue to smoke at the same time.
Right, cigarettes.
Right. So we have what's called dual use. So they're smoking when they can and using e-cigarettes when they can't, and that's not the answer either. So it has to be moving from smoking to possibly using e-cigarettes, exclusive use of e-cigarettes, but get rid of the smoking and keep it away from kids.
But Kristen, to a certain extent, when I went and looked up e-cigarettes and I went through Google Images, mm-hmm. I kind of see what you're saying, because they bejewel them. They make them very... The e-cigarettes are really pretty and shiny, and they put rhinestones on them.
The flavors appeal to, I think, the younger generation certainly too.
Right, and they make them with all these flavors. There's even a pumpkin spice flavored e-cigarette that I saw when I was looking through. So there is this problem. I'm talking to two doctors, but you guys are not marketing for e-cigarettes, and using this message of safer but not safe, that doesn't sell well.
Well, exactly. And I think the message that is being marketed to youth is not the message that we want. That's the problem. That's where there's a problem. And that's, you know, right now is really a critical time, because we need to make sure that we're really keeping our youth safe from this conflicting message.
Does that need to be regulated in the way that we regulate smoking ads for cigarettes, which are fairly highly regulated?
On the regulation side around marketing, in your lifetime, you've never seen a cigarette ad on television. They were banned in 1971. I'm assuming how old you are.
Yeah.
Okay. So
pretty
okay,
much.
We'll
yep.
Stop there.
Yeah.
But now e-cigarettes. Today, you can turn on many stations and see advertisements for e-cigarettes on television, elsewhere. There's no restrictions currently in the United States for advertising e-cigarettes. So that's an area that needs to be regulated, and not necessarily banned, but it needs to be done in a factual, informative way so that smokers can make the proper decisions to whether to use the product or not.
How do we solve, because some of this is just translation, right? Some of it is just message. How do we get the knowledge of doctors to the public in a way where it's not confusing or conflicting?
Well, let me start with that. And at Georgia State, we have one of the 14 grants that FDA has funded to provide the research to inform the public about tobacco and tobacco regulation and electronic products. And the study that we do annual surveys understanding how the public feels about e-cigarettes and what they think and what they know and who they trust. That type of information needs to be used to communicate to smokers clearly what we know and what we don't know, and that help them make an informed decision. Same with kids. We need to clearly communicate to kids that these products are not safe for them. If they've never smoked, they should stay away from these. The problem, as you said, though, is they're marketed in such a way
right.
that they're glamorous, attractive. They look like Apple products. They have flavors.
They do.
And people can use other drugs in them. So it gets to be very complicated. But communication, public education communication, hasn't been done well and is key to really moving us forward in this issue.
In the minute that we have left, Kristen, how can we improve the way where you get that information out that might counteract the marketing?
Well, I think even within the medical community, doctors can educate their patients. I encourage patients to, when they're seeing their physician on their yearly checkup, ask about e-cigarettes, ask what their doctor's perceptions may be, you know, ask advice, you know, from your pediatrician, how should I talk to my kids about these so that they understand that they are, you know, potentially dangerous and it shouldn't be a habit that they're picking up and things like that. So I encourage people to communicate with their healthcare providers and ask them for advice on how to, you know, address the issue with their children and with other smokers that they know.
That's Kristen Higgins from Emory's Winship Cancer Institute and Michael Erickson, Dean of Georgia State's School of Public Health. He's a lead researcher on a new study about how people perceive the risks of vaping. Around the holidays, maybe you're getting a few extra emails from friends and colleagues, and maybe you're deleting a few responses that were intended for one person, but instead are delivered to a whole bunch of people. The villain is that reply all button. Some people push it to excess, and that means it's time to open the gripe bag.
I don't like things now compared to the way they used to be.
You know what really grinds my gears?
All this progress. Phooey!
Will you please tell me why?
That's the way it was and we liked it.
Oh, get off my lawn!
Let me get the nice part out of the way first. I don't think everyone who uses reply all in their email wants to clog up my inbox. I think most people don't realize they've hit that button or maybe think everyone needs to read their note that says, not me, or congrats, or good for you, or I'm in. I might not even be bothered if I weren't already swimming in a deluge of email. I'm a journalist. I get hundreds of emails every day. I'm ruthless about deleting messages without reading them. I have to be. If I read everything, I'd never do anything else. So let me make the case for taking a little more care and adhering to a higher standard of email etiquette. The average American worker spends a quarter of their workday dealing with email. Most of us check it 36 times an hour. The majority of office workers are interrupted every 3 minutes, and it takes them almost half an hour to get back on task. Email costs businesses billions of dollars in lost productivity every year. So you can understand the context here. Your reply all might be sent with the best intentions, but it's paving that road to you know where. Reply all is rarely necessary. It is a waste of time, adding to an email flood that already wastes too much time. Yes, I could close out of email completely and not see the 14 reply all messages accumulated there. I've tried sending polite notes that say, please don't use reply all anymore. Just recently, I landed on an email chain with about 40 other people. And everyone felt the need to hit reply all before writing a brief congratulatory message. By the end of the day, I'd received almost 40 irrelevant emails from people I don't know. When I took a moment to send a message asking politely that the email stop, I got one response, LOL, and then the emails continued. Not surprisingly, the humor was lost on me. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. You can certainly add to the complaints about reply all emails, or if you have your own gripe, we want to hear you vent. We might feature your comments on the show, remember. Give us a call, 404-500-9457, or find us on social media. Our show is produced by Emily Curitan, Ryan McFadden, Sean Powers, and Trevor Young. Tanya Ott is our VP of radio. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.